Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Winston Collier, representing Defendant Appellant Rohan Herron. Your Honors, this case represents a classic example of the type of two-part interrogation that a majority of the United States Supreme Court disapproved of in Missouri v. Siebert. A new trial is warranted here because the District Court improperly allowed testimony given by Mr. Herron after an initial unwarned interrogation.
Mr. Collier, I want to focus on my concern about your argument. As I understand it, you're saying that when you look carefully at the Siebert decision, in fact, a majority, the rule one derives from that fairly split decision is one that does not require intentional behavior. And, you know, maybe that's right. But the problem is this Court has a number of decisions in which we have held that Justice Kennedy's concurring opinion is the one that we have decided to follow after Siebert. Rightly or wrongly, you know, we can discuss, but that does seem to be the law of this circuit at this point. So how do you get around that?
Well, first, Your Honor,
we have various cases, right?
Understood. And first, Your Honor, I would point out that if Justice Kennedy's concurring opinion is followed, that there's plenty of evidence here by which the district court could determine that the intent of the officers was to conduct exactly the type of two-part interrogation that they, in fact, conducted.
But don't you think the district court, well, I mean, I don't know about findings, but it looks to me like the district court found that there was just a slip-up, basically. Everybody was assuming that somebody else had given the Miranda warnings in the initial arrest setting. Turns out that was a mistake. You know, they have this lengthy period where the, you know, the 4 a.m. statement, if you will. So what makes you think that one could make such a finding of intentional two-step process?
Well, the district court did so hold. However, I think that's error for quite a number of reasons. Agent Scott and Agent Gumersheimer, who conducted the initial interrogation, were extremely experienced federal agents. They visited Mr. Herron on the night of his arrest in custodial interrogation in the police station at 4 a.m. and testified and interrogated him for 45 minutes.
Suppose he had been given Miranda warnings out there on the scene, and then he was taken back to this interrogation room. Is it your feeling he should have had a second round of warnings even then, or would the first round have been enough?
It is not. The first round would have been enough.
Okay.
Had he received his Miranda warnings, I wouldn't be standing here, at least with respect to this issue today.
Okay.
However, if I can return, please, to your previous point, there were several other factors that indicated to me that the district court clearly erred in finding that this was not an intentional two-step interrogation tactic. Agent Scott testified that when she is going to conduct an interview, that Miranda rights are appropriate in that situation and that she knew to give the Miranda warnings. She later testified that this was an interview, and in fact the DEA 6 report on that evening said interview of Rohan Herron. So there's no question but that she knew that the warnings were appropriate in that situation. She couldn't have reasonably thought that the police department actually gave the Miranda warnings precisely because Mr. Herron wasn't questioned that night. And the bottom line is that this was two federal agents who were there for 45 minutes getting what they indicated in the report was a confession. And both of them argue that it never once occurred to them to do it, even as a precaution. So even if everything they said was true, they believed the police station had done that, et cetera, these agents know that Miranda should be given in such a situation. In addition, the one and only report that we have of either interrogation was generated from the first. There was a DEA 6 report prepared at that time. In the second interrogation, there were no notes, there was no recording, there was no report. There's simply nothing that memorializes what took place in the second interrogation in any way. Now, that, in my mind,
was that first report introduced into evidence, or was it used just to refresh the recollection of the agents?
It did not come into trial.
Yeah.
However, as a practical matter, when Agent Regg, who was present for the second interrogation, testified at trial, any review that he did of notes necessarily came from the DEA 6 report of the first interrogation. And even more importantly than that, the only way that he could be effectively cross-examined was by using the DEA 6 report from the first interrogation, which of course would bring that in at that time. And so we're really talking about a legal fiction here. The district court said, we're going to keep out the first interrogation and allow introduction of the second interrogation, when all we really have is one. They merge into each other in the form of that report. As a result, I think there's no way that the district court could adequately get to a finding that there was no intent. And I think that really is the fundamental issue. Now, I do, if I could go back to the point that you made earlier, this court has spoken about Justice Kennedy's concurrence in a number of cases. And I don't read any of those cases as ever foreclosing the possibility that the Siebert rule, which is defendant-focused by nature, it turns on whether Miranda warnings after an initial interrogation could effectively serve their purpose. I don't think this court has ever categorically said that that only comes into play when there's a showing of intent. And what it has said in the 2008 Stewart decision, which I thank the government for bringing to the court's attention.
Mr. Stewart has been up and down a few times.
It would appear so. What the court did say in that situation is that it's the government's burden to show the lack of intent to engage in this type of situation, in any situation as we have here where a double interrogation has in fact occurred. Now, at the very least, the government has never made such a showing that the district court could find that it had met its burden to show the lack of such an interrogation. Now, if I could please, we're here for a second reason as well. A new trial is warranted here for an entirely independent reason. The district court abused its discretion and violated Mr. Heron's due process rights by failing to grant trial counsel's motion for a continuance.
So what specifically could Mr. Heron have done with the extra time if a continuance had been granted? Obviously, I mean, a great deal of time has passed now, and Mr. Heron has now had an opportunity to gather evidence that Mr. Hamilton was lying and that Mr. Hearn did not go on those other trips. What is the state of the record as to that evidence?
Well, the record hasn't been developed because of the district court's disposition on that particular point. However, had the district court granted the motion for continuance, what Mr. Hearn could have done was to negate the key element of intent.
Didn't his lawyer, though, say, gee, you know, if the only thing Mr. Hamilton says is, you know, it was in 2005 or something, that would be too diffuse and there wasn't much he could do. But if there was something more specific, then there's work he thought he might have done. There was a statement like that by his
lawyer. Correct, Your Honor. There was, and in fact, it was more specific. He said that the first notice of this, they began talking about it early in the year, and that the first trip happened sometime in February or immediately after February. So there was a date range that was far more specific than the year. So, yes, absolutely correct, but the fact that he narrowed the range would have allowed Mr. Heron's trial counsel to go out and obtain trucking records. You'll recall that Mr. Hamilton testified that all of this took place in Mr. Heron's truck. So he could have showed trucking records, cell phone records. He could have shown when and where the truck was filled up. He could have, in other words, shown that on those particular trips that Mr. Hamilton was testifying to, Mr. Heron was where he claimed to be and not where Mr. Hamilton said he was. Had he done that, the jury could not have gotten to intent. And I definitely wouldn't be here were that the case.
You still have a minute if you want it for your rebuttal.
Want to save some time for rebuttal?
I will, please.
Thank you, Mr. Collier. Mr. Clark.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm Stephen Clark, standing in for Mr. Simonson, who is ill today.
Mr. Clark, where in the record is there evidence supporting the district court's finding that Heron asked to speak to the officers? As far as I can tell, Agent Scott had no basis whatsoever to testify about this issue because she didn't receive the call.
You're correct. She did not receive the call. The call came, as I understand it, from the defendant going to the Fairview Heights Police Department, and the Fairview Heights Police Department relayed the information to Agent Scott.
Is that the whole of the evidence?
That's the whole of the evidence as to how the agents initially came to interview the defendant.
No, but is that the whole of the evidence that would support the district court's finding that he asked to speak to the officers?
I don't believe that there's anything else in the record indicating that the defendant asked other than what I've just described.
You know, I've been wondering, from a defendant's perspective, why would it matter to the voluntariness determination whether the omission of Miranda warnings from the first of the two interrogations was deliberate? Because in either case, a defendant thinks the cat is already out of the bag unless the officers do something to correct that misimpression at the second interrogation.
Your Honor, going back to the Seibert case, that does, well, actually the Elden case, does speak to that matter, and the court there determined that the matter was that the issue was a matter of whether or not the officers purposely had the interrogation. Purposely withheld the Miranda rights.
The government can't point to. You know, the Siebert decision is, it's just all over the, I mean, it's issued by a very divided court.
Yes.
And the government can't point to five justices taking a view that Siebert requires a showing that the officers deliberately intended to sidestep Miranda. It seems to me, you know, the officer's intent is irrelevant to the question of whether the second statement made after the Miranda warnings is given voluntarily.
I'm sorry, you're saying that the officer's intent would be irrelevant as to which?
To the question of whether the second statement, which was made after the Miranda warnings were given, was given voluntarily. So, I mean, if the officers don't do anything to, the defendant, as I said before, knows that the cat is out of the bag, or he's going to believe it, and if the officers don't correct that misimpression when they finally give the Miranda warning, a defendant surely must think that the jig is up because he's already made incriminating statements, and then he repeats them under the tank of the first improper interrogation. In other words, in short, I guess what I'm trying to get at is that I can't find a reason here to believe that the officers simply forgot the warnings the first time around. That first meeting, in my view, was clearly an interrogation. And the second meeting came out so soon after the first one, and it involved one of the same officers. It seems to me the defendant thought, well, the cat is already out of the bag.
Well, I don't think that there's anything in the record to indicate specifically that the defendant had that thought. On the other hand, I think that both the Elden case and the Seibert case indicate that the harmfulness here is, or in such a case, comes where there is a purposeful withholding. And this case is so different from the Seibert case as to be significantly distinguishable, namely that there is no evidence, and the district court so found, there is no evidence that there was a purposeful attempt to withhold the Miranda rights on that first meeting.
But it's an interesting focus, and one which somehow changes Miranda itself from a rule protective of the defendant's Fifth Amendment rights to a police misconduct kind of rule. It seems strange. And this Court's decisions have been a little inconsistent. Some of them have said, well, you know, we know what to do if there's a deliberate two-step process, but we don't have before us something that's less deliberate. There language reserving this possibility, whereas, and so if we were to agree with you that this is not a deliberate case, we might still have a question of trying to read the tea leaves in Siebert to figure out what it is the majority of the court would do. It's certainly true that there's not a majority in the court for Justice Kennedy's rule. He was writing for himself and maybe one other.
That's correct. On the other hand, the plurality in Siebert, page 615, does say it's fair to read Elstadt as treating the living room conversation, which was the first conversation in that case, as a good faith Miranda mistake, not only open to correction by careful warning before systematic questioning, but posing no threat to the warned first practice generally. And at the opposite extreme are the facts here, meaning in Siebert, which by any objective measure reveal a strategy adapted to undermine the Miranda warnings.
I just don't understand the argument that a reasonable person would know that these were two separate interrogations. At the second interrogation, as I said earlier, one of the officers from the first interrogation is sitting there listening. It's the very next day, so you don't have this great separation in time. They're at the same location. He's already been arrested. He's clearly in custody. I don't think you have even one of the Elstadt factors in your favor. Even if we were to decide that Elstadt, you know, provides the proper analysis, because on what basis can we find that a lack of voluntariness from the first interrogation does not carry over into the second interrogation? I don't get it.
I think that the primary factor there, Your Honor, would be the 32-hour separation. But I'm not sure that you even get to those factors when, if you look at the Kennedy concurrence in Seibert, where there is no purposeful withholding of the Miranda rights. I think if the judge finds, as he did here, that it was not purposeful, then it is permissible for the investigators to interrogate following Miranda warnings.
Could you say a quick word about the continuance? Because I was concerned with this. We always speak of the 11th hour, but this was almost literally the 11th hour, and it's such a material change in Mr. Hamilton's story about what happened, and it seems that the government wasn't even objecting to some brief continuance so that the defense could look into it. I was not particularly impressed by the cross-examination that was possible. The defense lawyer was left with just trying to show that get Mr. Hamilton to admit that he was a liar, and Mr. Hamilton doesn't really do that. I mean, as opposed to concrete evidence of receipts of trips and gasoline and motels and whatever. It's a completely different picture.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand the question. Various factors that of the various factors that need to be reviewed here, I think the most important is that the likelihood of prejudice issue. And here the defense counsel conceded before the interview that he might not need a continuance if Heron did not provide specific dates. I think it's important, as you noted earlier, that the defense counsel did not renew his request for a continuance after he did interview the the witness. And I should reiterate.
But sometimes there are definitive rulings, too. I mean, you can't ask defense counsel to just constantly be popping up and reiterating objections.
Sure, I understand that, Your Honor. But there's no evidence in the record that he believed that he would obtain anything other than what he'd already gotten that would help him in his cross-examination of the defense. Of course, in terms of the timeliness, the government only obtained this information at about the same time that the defense did. We immediately made it known to the defense.
Well, right, no, I'm not criticizing the government for that. It's more, why was it not an abuse of discretion under these conditions not to give defense counsel a reasonable amount of time to look into this very significant change of position?
Well, again, I think that the witness, that the defense was given an opportunity to interview the witness. He could have, as a result of that, said, again, Judge, I need more time.
But that was not at all what they wanted to use the time for. And I think even the government pointed out that the witness might not want to talk to defense counsel.
But he did, Your Honor.
Oh, we don't know.
We don't know what he said. We can assume he probably said the same thing. Oh, well, now I'm going to say it's two trips. I mean, you need some objection. You wouldn't want to be in that position. You need some evidence to show that the witness is not telling the truth.
Well, I agree that I don't know what actually went on between the two of them, but nevertheless, the defense lawyer did not seek anything further as a result of what he talked to the defendant about.
Okay.
Well, thank you.
I was fascinated by the argument that Hamill's testimony about these other trips wasn't even essential to the government's case, so the evidence couldn't have affected the outcome. If it's true that the testimony wasn't essential to the government's case, why would you seek to admit evidence? It seems to be pure propensity evidence.
I would agree that it does seem to be that way, Your Honor, for the reasons that were outlined in the brief. I see my time's up, but for the reasons outlined in the brief, I think there was substantial other evidence besides that. So regardless of whether the 404B evidence is pertinent or not, there was substantially other evidence to prove the defendant's guilt.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Mr. Collier?
May it please the Court, I have just a couple of points related to each part of this case. First, the Court definitely correctly recognizes that Siebert is a badly splintered decision, and this is something where I would ask that this Court help clarify. Siebert is defendant-focused. It should apply wherever a double interrogation creates a risk that Miranda warnings could not accomplish their purpose. And as this Court just pointed out, that's consistent with the fundamental focus of Miranda itself. Here, that definitely would not be the case, because in the second interrogation, there was a witness, there was an interrogator in common. Agent Scott was there for both. And the agents had access to the DEA 6 reports. Agent Regg also testified that the second testimony was essentially the same as the first testimony. So I think it's very clear that Mr. Herron didn't understand after the first that he could effectively and validly waive his rights under Miranda. Second, the district court, in making its determination, I think relied on incorrect inputs. The court never did challenge the conflicting statements by Agent Scott with respect to whether or not this was really an interrogation. And in addition, it assumed that Agent Scott received the call when, in fact, we know that it was Agent Gumersheimer, if at all. And the reason I say that is because Agent Gumersheimer never testified at the suppression hearing. If I could turn, please, briefly to the motion to continue.
Well, Ms. Collier, before you leave that, you aren't challenging that Mr. Herron sought to speak to the authorities.
I don't think we have ample evidence that he did.
Agent, contrary evidence, unless it's the credibility. You're challenging the credibility of the.
I'm absolutely not challenging the credibility of the officers, but the court relied on a mistaken belief that Agent Scott received the call.
What is the difference? I mean, in reality, you get this as you, I'm sure, aware with these task force situations. What if the call had just come to the a receptionist at the police department who was aware of that he or she is not going to be the person to talk to Mr. Herron, calls another law enforcement agency that's, or the same law enforcement agency? Why should that be suspect or even a question unless there's credibility attendant that dialogue?
Well, sure, Your Honor. This is the basic problem with a lack of direct knowledge. Agent Scott could have had the best intentions in the world with respect to that part. I still think that she intentionally engaged in a two-part interrogation. But with respect to that part, she was getting the information from another source. And when she testified that this call came in, she didn't know and couldn't have known what was said in the call. So the fact is, and she also said, she testified that she thought the call went to Agent Gumersheimer. So it's not even certain that she knew who received the call.
But the call was just to contact, to speak to authorities. No information was conveyed by Mr. Herron to anyone, was it?
In the call?
Yeah.
We simply don't know the content of the call. I would presume that no information was conveyed by Mr. Herron. But the problem with the lack of direct knowledge is that no one knows what was said in that call, and that none of the testimony in the motion to suppress hearing does anything to clear that up.
Well, was an opportunity presented to defense counsel to do that?
Defense counsel, of course, could have called whomever he wanted in the motion. But the fact is, the court erroneously relied on an assumption that Agent Scott received that call. That was something that actually was left unchallenged.
That's my focus, I think. Suppose the court is erroneous, and it was the receptionist or another Fairview Heights police officer.
Okay.
Why is that critical, I guess, is my inquiry?
Because the court decided that this couldn't be a double interrogation, an intentional double interrogation, because it believed that Mr. Herron made a call and asked, but not only made a call, but asked for the agents to come and interrogate him. Keep in mind that this is 4 a.m. on the night that he was arrested, that he's making this request, according to the testimony.
It's not unheard of that in his situation, he might have reflected that his circumstances might improve by an initial first-in approach.
None of us in this room and no one in the case could know what was said because we never had testimony from the person who received that call.
Are you premising that there's the potential that there's a sham situation here, that the Scott arrival was somehow prearranged in a fashion not consistent with Mr. Herron reaching out to wanting to speak to authorities?
Well, with respect to the particular point as to the phone conversations, I wouldn't have the information to say one way or another what the officer's intent was. I do, however, think that the information clearly supports the double interrogation and the fact that the officers intended to interrogate, gain a confession, read Miranda, reinterrogate, and use the one and only record from the first interrogation. As to the rest of it, Your Honor, I simply can't say. If I could mention just a couple of points about the motion to continue, the government, in fact, did not object, and the district court's denial of the motion was categorical. This is something that it would have been futile to try to renew. And I would simply turn the court's attention in the briefing to the Vincent factors, which, taken in its totality, go very strongly to an abuse of discretion in this situation. We know, and this is the key one, although the briefing spells out all of them, that not only was there a likelihood of prejudice, which is one of the factors, but there was actual prejudice because this was a crucial witness and because the addition of these two trips to the testimony offered elsewhere in trial established the element of intent. They changed this from a single trip across the country where Mr. Herron was in one location and needed to get back to Massachusetts where he lived, and made him instead into an active participant in a business enterprise, and that, I think, is what the jury found.
Thank you, Ms. Collier.
Thank you.
Ms. Collier, I want to add an additional thanks to you and co-counsel Ms. Newman and, of course, your law firm for accepting the appointment in this case and ably representing Mr. Hearn.
I appreciate that. It's our pleasure, Your Honor.
Thanks, as always. The case is taken under advisement.